The House of Run podcast.
What are you into these days?
Mostly running, Hal.
Running.
Yeah. Look at Bill! Look at Bill!
Coming on! Bill is coming on!
Oh, no! I'm not thinking about making the team. I'm thinking about gold in Munich.
What can I say? I got beat by a zebra.
Starts now.
Welcome back to the House of Run podcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading. houseofrun@gmail.com is our email address. houseofrun.com is where you can find all of our podcasts. We're also on Twitter, twitter.com/houseofrun. Our voicemail line, 206-339-4387. My name is Kevin. I'm usually joined by my co-host, Jason. Unfortunately, he is sick tonight, has some food poisoning. He will not be joining me, but I am joined by someone tonight, and that person is the Canadian record holder in the 10,000 meters, also a two-time NCAA champion for the University of Wisconsin. He now competes for the Oregon Track Club in Portland, Oregon. His name is Simon Byrou. Simon, welcome to the House of Run. Thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Simon, before we get started, you just launched your own website, simonbyrou.com. What's it like to have your own site?
Yeah, it's one of those things where I've been sending emails for the last couple of years to just a small group of people with just, you know, blog updates on how the season's been going, and I thought maybe I could open it up to more people by having a website, and, you know, if people can get something out of it, that'd be great. So it was just one of those ideas that kind of came suddenly, and the response has been awesome. I think I've been getting a lot of positive feedback so far.
And you're one of the only distance guys, it seems like, that has their own site. A lot of the track, you know, the sprinter types have their own sites, but not many of the big names like yourself have websites. Why is that? What's up with some of your teammates and fellow competitors out there?
I mean, you know, everyone has their own reasons. Obviously, there's a lot of work that goes with it. And you know, some people on our team aren't really comfortable with blogging. So it's not really, I don't think it's something that everyone's comfortable with. I've always never really had a problem with, you know, expressing my views or, you know, just kind of talking about my training or, you know, how my workouts are going, and I think that was just a nice progression towards, you know, starting your own website.
All right, well, let's get into the recent news that you made besides for the website, which was the two races that you're going to be competing in. One of them is an 8K in Chicago on April 10th, and then a return to the marathon in Toronto in October. Let's start first with this 8K. What was the thought process going into choosing that race? Was it very involved, or was it more of a just trying to get back out to racing again?
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, I've had some minor injury problems that kind of hampered my training earlier in the year, and I thought it would be nice to kind of get, you know, a nice time trial type of race in first before, you know, I start mixing it up with some of the big guys. And, you know, this opportunity came up, and, you know, it's a great course, a great atmosphere. And so I thought, you know, why not just kind of go out there and run an 8K and then take it from there.
And for the marathon, this will be your second marathon. The New York City Marathon didn't go as you would have planned it. Was there any hesitation on your part to step back into the marathon after that experience? Any thought at going into different distances, or was it more of a situation where you wanted to try to get another marathon on your belt as quickly, as realistically as possible?
Yeah, there was really no regrets or hesitation after New York. You know, obviously it didn't go the way I wanted, but, you know, the marathon's tough, and it's going to take a while to figure it out. You know, it would just be asking too much to kind of go out there on your first shot and, you know, run a 209 in on one of the toughest courses in the world. So, you know, you kind of take it in stride, and, you know, there was a lot of good that came out of New York as well as, you know, bad, obviously. And, you know, it never really fazed me. And I knew that, you know, it might take two or three marathons before I really hit my stride with the marathon. And, you know, I'm confident that at the end of the day, I'm going to figure it out and, you know, hopefully do some special things in the distance. But, you know, right now all you can do is kind of take it one race at a time, and I'm going to take what I learned in New York and apply it to Toronto, and I know that I'll make some improvements, but, you know, at the end of the day, I'm probably still not going to be where I want to be after Toronto.
What were some of the things that you took away from the New York City experience?
Well, you know, I was really able to stay relaxed. I never realized the fluctuation in pace that we were running at the beginning. I think we were, you know, we were anywhere from 5:50 to 4:29 in that first, 16 miles or so. And, you know, I never realized that until I saw it on paper. And I think the fact that I was kind of able to maintain my composure through most of that until the end, was, you know, a positive sign. And it just showed that I just need to kind of callus my body a little bit more to road racing and just get a little bit stronger to finish it off. But, you know, the first 15, 16 miles, which I know that's the easiest part of the marathon, but still was, you know, going as well as I could have hoped. And I think, you know, with that also, you know, I had to practice on my fueling and, you know, get that down a little bit better. And from talking to some of the other veterans of the marathon, they said, you know, that's going to take a while. But overall, the ending didn't go the way I wanted, but I definitely got a lot of positive feedback out of that, just in terms of being able to keep my composure for as long as I did.
You mentioned the pace fluctuations when you look back at that race, and even when you watched it on TV at the time, or you watch a tape of it now, it was pretty ridiculous. Once Haile Gebrselassie dropped out, how quickly the pace accelerated down to, you know, sub 4:30. What's that like from a runner's perspective? I mean, is there anything in your training that you could do to simulate that? And when that was happening in the race, what was going through your head?
Well, I was really praying that he'd hold on for two more miles. You know, because as soon as he dropped off, you know, the leaders kind of looked at each other, and then they kind of looked back to make sure that he was definitely dropping off, and then it was just a sprint. So I think, you know, there was a lot of respect for Haile there, and no one was going to do that if he was in the race. So, you know, that hurt me. But, you know, overall, I just got to get stronger. The marathon comes down to, you know, the strongest guys in the race are going to do the best. And, you know, it was my first marathon. My mileage was about as high as it's ever been, but I'm probably going to have to increase that a little bit more for the next marathon here. And, you know, I think it's just, you just got to be patient. It's a tough race. It's very unpredictable. You know, unfortunately, I think I was probably, you know, conservatively speaking, 2:10:30, you know, 2:11 to 2:10:30 shape going into New York. But, you know, with the pacing and just the unpredictability of the race, I wasn't really able to run anywhere close to that, obviously. So I think it just, like I said, it just comes down to I got to get stronger.
So prior to New York City, you were asked a ton. It seemed like every interview you gave about that Canadian marathon record of 2:10:09. So I thought I'd ask it to you again as you prepare for Toronto. How important is that record when setting your expectations for your next race here in October?
Honestly, it's not important at all. I mean, mm-hmm. This race is only about one thing, and that's making the Olympic team. I think, you know, anything, you got to get to the Olympics. That's what we trained for 4 years. That's our big stage. That's our race. So anything after that is really icing on the cake, and that's the way I'm approaching Toronto. Is, you know, make sure you secure a spot on the team. You know, there's a lot of great guys right now in the Canadian marathon scene, so that's by far not going to be easy to do. But, you know, I'm confident by October I'll be there and I'll be ready to do it. But that's really the only goal right now, is just making the Olympic team. And then after that, you know, 2013 will be a year where I'll say, you know, I'm going for the record. It doesn't mean that I don't think I could break it, you know. Mm-hmm. It might happen this year. It might happen next year. I don't really know, but that's really not the goal. Usually that's not how it works with records. You know, you feel good and it kind of just happens. You know, you can't really force the issue. And that's kind of always been my approach when it comes to records. It's just run well, you know, take care of the little things. And then at the end, if the record was meant to go down, it will.
What's the course like in Toronto? We don't hear about it too much in the United States. I'm assuming it's faster than New York City, correct?
Yeah, it's completely flat. It's a fast course. The race director, he's really good with rabbits. I think last year they had rabbits running, I think it was like maybe 2:10:30 for about 30K of the race. So it's pretty much set up to run fast in that race. I think it's kind of like the Stanford of marathons from what I understand.
Well, the race, as you mentioned before, is going to feature four other top Canadians, but you're being billed as the favorite. Now, when you race in New York City, there's a bunch of other top names that kept you very much under the radar. How does that change your approach at all?
No, you know, honestly, with every race, there's always going to be some sort of hype or talk on you're the underdog, you're the favorite. I really just block that out because you're just running. And you know, I think if races were, you know, if you could, like, tell who's going to win a race on paper, we wouldn't run the race. You know, it's like any other sport. You just go out there and you run, and I don't really let it get to me whether I'm a huge underdog or a huge favorite, because at the end of the day, you still have to run the race, and, you know, you got to complete the whole 26.2 miles. So that kind of stuff, it's always going to be there, but, you know, I think I do a pretty good job of kind of phasing that out and not really focusing in on it.
So the goal is top three. This is being used as the Canadian Olympic marathon trials. Am I correct?
Yep. Yeah.
And do you have to get under that Olympic standard of 2:11:30 in that race?
No, I think that's probably going to be the best opportunity to do it. But I think we have till maybe whenever London is in spring to get that standard. So I think there's going to be a couple more opportunities if need be. But you know, the way I see it, if it doesn't happen in Toronto, it's probably not going to happen. So I think the other guys are probably looking at it with the same approach. So yeah, it's basically Toronto's become kind of a, you know, all or nothing for the marathon team.
Now, do you like that scenario? Are you a runner in your past? I mean, you've won championships in high pressure races in NCAAs and things like that. Is that a scenario that you like? Or would you prefer, well, I guess this is sort of an easy question, everybody prefers less pressure, but are you worried at all about putting kind of all your eggs in one basket?
No, honestly, I love the pressure. I think I've always done well with pressure. You know, I think before World Cross last year, you know, in December, I said my goal was top 10. And obviously, I didn't quite accomplish that, but, you know, I was about 6 seconds off fifth place. And I think I use that kind of pressure to just kind of to challenge myself during workouts and kind of just get fired up before the race. So, you know, I've always been someone who, you know, tries to excel with the pressure. And the more pressure, the better for me. So I wish this was a one-time thing. I wish it was, you know, this is the last opportunity to make the marathon. And that's the way I'm looking at it. And that's the way Terry's preparing me for it. This is it. You know, if you don't do it here, there isn't going to be another shot to make the Olympic team in the marathon. So that's definitely going to be my approach going into it.
All around the world, it seems like top runners are migrating sooner and sooner, younger and younger ages to the marathon. You made a relatively early, I guess you could say, at least in terms of U.S., in the U.S. college system, a transition to the marathon distance. Do you regret not going to the marathon sooner when you see some of these guys now at, you know, 22, 23, 24 running in the marathon, or do you think you made the transition at the right time?
No, I think I made it at the right time. Jerry, I think I remember as far back as, you know, my junior year at Wisconsin, Jerry telling me I'm going to be a marathoner. And you know, at the time, I wasn't too hot on the idea. I was kind of intimidated by the distance. But, you know, me and Jerry, we discussed it, and we knew that we were going to take our time. Because, you know, even now, I still have, you know, I plan on running till I'm in my mid to late 30s. So that's a long time to be running the marathon. So we wanted to make sure that I was physically and, you know, mentally ready to kind of take on that task, because it's grueling. The training for a marathon is hard. You know, the actual race is obviously hard. And if you're going to do that consistently over a number of years, you know, you got to make sure you don't rush into it. And I think we've done, and that's just for me. I'm not speaking for other people, but I think we've really set me up to really do some great things over the next, you know, 6 to 8 years.
You mentioned your coach, Jerry Schumacher, same coach you had in Wisconsin in your college days. Not many people have that setup. Is there much of a difference working with Coach Schumacher now than when you were in college, or pretty much the same guy?
Yeah, it's just the relationship has just kind of grown, and I think there's more trust than there was back then. I think, you know, Jerry didn't trust me as much, rightfully so, because I was younger and probably not as mature as I am now, obviously. Well, hopefully. And, you know, I think just with any relationship, you know, there's going to be some growing involved, and I think now we're at a point where we completely understand each other. And, you know, when he tells me something, I know where he's coming from. It's not really, you know, out of the dark. And I think just it's that unique ability to really understand someone that only comes from years of being together. And I think, you know, we're very fortunate to have that. Me as well as my teammates, just being able, you know, I've only had two coaches my entire career, my high school coach and Jerry. So I think there's a lot of positive that comes from that kind of consistency.
A couple years ago, you made that move from Wisconsin to Portland. What was the biggest adjustment moving to the Northwest?
It's all been good adjustments. I think the biggest was probably running on grass in January. It kind of took a while to get used to. You know, we weren't really used to that. You know, the support that we get here from Nike has been amazing in terms of, you know, just getting shoes or whatever it is. And I think just being able to really train full-time as elite athletes, whereas in Wisconsin, you know, there was obviously school, and then after that, there was, you know, there's only so much you can do in the winter time. So that was kind of a buffer zone for us. We weren't really able to train hard all year round, whereas now, you know, the weather is perfect here. You could train hard all year round, and I think a lot of us have made the jumps that we've made because we're actually able to train hard 12 months out of the year, whereas, like I say, in Wisconsin, it was maybe 8 to 7 months out of the year that we were actually training hard.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. You're a professional runner now, like you said, more time to train than when you're in college. Running aside, how do you fill your time? I mean, can you walk us through a typical day in the life of Simon Byrou?
Let's see. I guess it kind of varies day to day or even month to month or season to season. But, you know, on average, I think we get up at 7:30 every morning, you know, 5 days a week, actually, not every morning. And, you know, we're at Nike at 8:30. We get our 10 to 11 mile run in, and then we have a strength work with Pascal Dobert, who's also Wisconsin alumni and Olympic steeplechase runner for the U.S. And we usually get done by about noon with our strength and conditioning, come home, get something to eat, usually take a little nap after that, and then get our second run in. And about 4 o'clock is usually when my free time starts. And, you know, depending on when it is, I'll either spend it, you know, just hanging out with some friends, or I'm also involved with the Big Brother program here in Portland. So I've got an 11-year-old kid who I usually hang out with when I get the chance. So it's, you know, it's really good to just have distractions. I don't think it's healthy to be, you know, running 24/7. You know, I like to kind of like remove myself from running at times just to kind of keep it fresh in my mind. And, you know, I think it really, for me personally, it really helps me kind of stay energized with the sport because, you know, the work we do here is it's grueling. It's going to beat you up. Just, you know, day in and day out, we're basically doing, you know, the same thing over and over and over again. So I like to kind of do non-running stuff on in my free time.
You mentioned naps. Are you a good napper? Are you the type of guy who needs to force yourself to take a nap, or does that come naturally to you?
I was. Now I'm just, as soon as I lay down, I'll fall asleep. You know, like I said, it comes with the training. When you're doing 120 miles a week, it's not too hard to fall asleep. So it's definitely something that it's taken a while. I wasn't really a big napper back in the day. I think I only started napping last year or so.
Not even in college.
It's been great.
Not even in college.
No, yeah. No, honestly, in college, I think I slept about 4 or 5 hours a night. I wasn't a big sleeper.
Oh,
it was really bad. Yeah, I mean, the year I won NCs, I slept about an hour. So in 2004, when I won cross country nationals, I slept about an hour total
each night.
And, no, like the night before the race.
Oh, the night before the race. I said that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah. No, so you know, we've always, you know, Bobby and I remember back. Bobby Lockhart, who's a coach at Oklahoma State now, I remember we would be up till 3 a.m. you know, watching TV in our hotel room before the, you know, the Big Ten Conference or Roy Griak, and Jerry would always make sure his room was right next door to us just to make sure we were sleeping. we weren't big sleepers, and I think, you know, it kind of freaked him out a little bit, but he kind of got used to it over the years. Now with just the training that we're doing, it's impossible to do that, and I try to get at least 8 hours of sleep a day.
Well, right now, you mentioned you spend a lot of your time probably at the Nike campus and doing things over there. There's a ton of top runners in Portland. Several of them also run for Nike in the other group, the Alberto Salazar group, that's now named the Nike Oregon Project. Galen Rupp, Alan Webb, Dathan Ritzenhine, Mo Farah. I'd imagine you run into those guys on a daily basis. What's the relationship like between the two groups?
You know, I actually don't see them that much, to be honest with you. They're kind of on a different schedule. We're there, I think they're there a little bit later than us. We're usually, like I said, we start our runs at 8:30 in the morning. So it's just the off day, you know, I'll see them maybe once a week, to be honest with you. But it's, you know, we're friends. We're obviously competitors, but at the same time, we, you know, if we see each other, we'll go on a run sometimes, or, you know, ask Dathan how the kids are doing, or, you know, whatever it may be, how training's going. So very casual, but yeah, we don't really see each other as much as I think people think.
So there's not this huge hidden rivalry that everyone wants to manufacture and think that's going on there? That's not really happening?
I mean, of course, you know, when I'm racing those guys, I want to beat them, but, you know, I want to beat my teammates too. So it's really, there's nothing out of the ordinary in there, really. It's, you know, it's just, you want to beat everybody you race, obviously. But I would say I would definitely consider them friends when I see those guys.
The group you train with, a lot of your former teammates from Wisconsin. It seems like from an outside perspective, they generally enjoy training together, and you guys generally enjoy each other's company. Is that a correct assumption?
Yeah, you know, it's really I almost feel like we're a family more than just teammates. It's really, you know, it's such a unique perspective or a unique situation where you can be with the same guys for probably almost 9-10 years now. You know, when you're with people that long, there's going to be some close bonds that develop from that situation. And, you know, we hang out outside of practice a lot. I think, even in practice with guys that good, you would think, you know, there would be a lot of competition within practice, but there really isn't. I think everyone kind of understands that, if we're all going to do well as an individual, the entire group needs to do well just to kind of push each other. And, you know, there's a lot of that support. You know, I think I mentioned in past interviews, you know, there'll be times when Matt will pull someone aside and say, hey, you need to start doing this more if you're going to, you know, if you want to run well in the five or if you want to run well in the marathon. And, you know, there's a lot of that between the guys. So it's a really unique situation. It's almost like, you know, training with family members than just a bunch of guys.
Is that something that Jerry Schumacher goes out of his way to sort of instill and foster in the group, or is that something that sort of organically comes from you guys?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, when you're with the same guys for almost 10 years, that's bound to happen. There's really no way around it. You know, so I think it's just something that kind of developed from, you know, kind of going through the Wisconsin ranks together and, you know, moving out here together. And, you know, there's been a lot of growing pains for everybody. So we've all seen each other's, you know, upsides and downsides and, you know, the frustrations and, you know, the highlights of our careers all kind of come together. So I think when you share that kind of relationship, there's going to be a bond.
When you were running with these guys in college, did you ever think that you would still have such a close relationship with them now and that you'd be training with them this many years later?
No, honestly, I didn't even think about the whole going pro thing until Matt did it. So, which would have been my senior year. I don't think I really, you know, when I won cross country nationals in 2004, Jerry said, you know, you might be good enough to go pro. You know, you know, I was like, really? You think so? He's like, yeah, maybe. He's like, you're gonna have to get your track times down. And so it was really like this, you know, abstract thought where it wasn't really, realistic for me until, you know, Matt got all his Nike gear, and I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, maybe this is something that I could do. So it kind of started from that, and I think after that, we kind of knew that we would be together for a while.
How does that work? I think a lot of people, myself included, you know, don't really understand the whole process, you know, of going pro in the NBA or the NFL. You know, you got the draft, and everyone goes up there, and they put on the hat, and they shake hands with the commissioner with the jersey. In running, all of a sudden, we just see a result pop up with a shoe company near your name. What's that process like of transitioning, and you know, what sort of stuff goes on there between amateur to pro?
Well, you know, first thing, the most important thing you do right out of college is find a good agent. You know, find an agency that you feel comfortable being with, and you know, this is almost it's like picking a school. You know, out of high school, like. It's a tough decision. There's a lot of good agents out there, and they all kind of, you know, have different things that they offer, and they'll tell you great things, and it's kind of, you just got to kind of, you know, go through it and decide what is the best fit for you. You know, for me, I never really had a choice, so to speak. You know, we're all with Kimbia, Tom Ratcliffe. He's the greatest. He's like part of the team now. You know, he's just as important as Jerry to our team in some aspects. And so the way it happened for us is Pascal ran for Kim McDonald, who Tom worked with, the late Kim McDonald. So, you know, Pascal kind of referenced him to Matt, and Matt and him talked, and, you know, Matt really thought, you know, highly of Tom Ratcliffe. So he signed with him. And after that, you know, we all knew we wanted to be with the same agency. Just, we thought it would make things easier. And, you know, I talked to Tom, and we hit it off instantly. I thought he was amazing, and, you know, he's really doing all the things I was looking for. And so once I got out of college, I also signed with Tom Ratcliffe. And then once that process is over, Tom will negotiate on your behalf to the shoe companies and try to get you the best deal. And, you know, there's during that kind of phase where you're not really sure who you're going to go with, some of the shoe companies will send you some gear just to test out. And, you know, at the end of the day, Nike was the best fit for me. And, you know, so we signed the contract with Nike and it kind of went from there.
And now you're on billboards, right? That's you on those billboards?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
Or is that Evan? Well, I don't remember which. I remember some of the guys in that group were on billboards. It might have been Evan Yeager that I was thinking of. But
his are the most famous ones. Evan's been on billboards all over the world. So I think those are the ones you're thinking of. I mean, I've been in like a couple of sport checks, but I'm sure you were thinking of Evan.
So why is he getting on billboards, but you're not? I mean, is there a reason there's something going on behind the scenes?
He's way better looking, that's why.
let's talk.
He's got that Justin Bieber look going.
Let's talk.
I just said that because he's standing right in front of me. I didn't actually mean it.
Well, I want to ask some questions about some of your teammates. Hypothetically, I think there's 9 of you now, right? Including.
You're not going to get me in trouble, are you?
No. These are all. These are all complimentary questions. Hypothetically, so if all nine of you are on a run, and I think there's 9 of you, and you're in Portland, which is fairly running knowledgeable, which one is most likely to get recognized?
You know what? I think it would be – well, from runs that I've gone on, Matt Tegenkamp usually gets the most recognition on runs. Mm-hmm. And then I would probably be – I mean, I don't run with Chris that much, mm-hmm. but I think Matt and I get a lot of recognition, but Matt by far gets way more than anyone. And I'm sure Shalane does too. Mm-hmm. But I guess it depends on what kind of people you're talking about. If we're talking about, like, the high school guys, I would say Shalane. I don't know. I'm not sure. I would probably say Matt.
And when you get recognized, what do people normally say? What's the first thing?
I mean, we kind of all get the Go Badgers.
Oh, okay. Which is probably tough because you're up there in Pac-10 country. So it's that's a big compliment.
I mean, honestly, there's a lot of Badger alums here. We were just at the bar watching the Butler-Wisconsin game, and the entire bar was full of Wisconsin Badger fans. So I'm not sure how that worked out, but there's a lot of Midwest transplants out here.
I guess they must have came for the slightly better weather, not completely better.
Yeah,
better. All right, which one would most likely push the pace on an easy run?
Oh, that's easily Chris. You kind of have to pump the brakes on that kid. Probably Lopez. Lopez is second.
What's that like? Now, he's new to the group, correct?
Yeah, he's been with us for about 3 weeks now, maybe 3 or 4 weeks.
How's that transition going for him?
Really good. You know, he kind of clicked instantly. He's a great guy, and he never really had a problem. I think he went from not really training a lot. He was in Africa for a while, and it was a struggle at first just with the, you know, strength and conditioning work and the running and everything. But as of recently, he's really been, you know, hitting his stride and just killing the workouts.
So now you have Lopez, who's focusing more on 1500, I would assume, and then you have – you know, you and Tim Nelson and Shalane, who are, you know, marathoners. Do you, besides for the strength stuff, how much do you guys work together within your running?
You know, we on non-workout days, we always run together. It's just people will just kind of check off when they need to. You know, you've got guys like, you know, Evan or Lopez will do anywhere from 50 to 60 minutes to, you know, Chris, who's doing 90 minutes, and everyone else is in between somewhere. So we all just kind of start off together, and then you check off when you're done. So we do a lot of that together. During the fall, you know, I always think we're all marathoners. I'm doing bodybuilding, so we all kind of do a lot of the similar workouts. It's more in the spring that we kind of break off into our designated events. So you'll have, you know, the 5K guys, and then basically the marathoners in a different group.
And this summer, a lot of them are going to be in Europe, I'm assuming. Does that mean, are you going to just tag along in Europe and go for a vacation, or are you going to be stuck back in Portland?
No, yeah. We're going to St. Moritz for altitude training, and the guys will all be getting ready for Daegu, so I'm just going to tag along just so I have training partners and, you know, get the altitude training in as well. And, yeah, so I'll be out there. And those guys will be racing on the track, obviously, and I'm going to look for a couple of road races while I'm out there.
All right, I got one more for you, and this one won't get you in trouble. It'll actually probably get you some praise. Which one of your teammates cooks the best meal?
Oh, that's easy. I would say me. And I'm not just saying that.
What do you
cook? I'm probably the best cook. Let's see. My lasagna is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
My fresh meatball subs that I make are pretty good. What else do I have? Make a lot of Italian food. I think. I don't even know who would be second.
It's not even close.
Probably, I'll give Evan second. His nachos are pretty good. But, yeah, I would say there's me, and then, like, there's a huge gap, and then Evan, and then everyone else is kind of, like, below him.
Oh, wow. Do you have team dinners often? Do you get to show off your cooking, or is this something you keep to yourself?
You know, if someone does something really well, I'll treat them with dinner, because, I mean, they're going to have to run really well to get my food. It's a treat. So, overall, you know, I usually don't cook for someone unless, you know, I think the last time I cooked for someone was probably Chris. Yeah, I cooked for Chris when he booked 27. I made him something, I think. I'm not sure. But, I mean, like I said, it's really a treat, and I don't think people should just get it for no reason. They're going to have to do something really special.
Italian cooking, that sort of comes out of left field. I mean, where did you learn that?
You know what? I've always liked Italian food, and I just kind of taught myself. I mean, my mom was a good cook, too. I think I got a little bit from her. You know, Italy did once, I think, influence a lot of Ethiopian culture. So I think maybe that's where she got it from. But, I kind of took the hint from my mom, but for the most part taught myself in college.
All right. Well, now we have Simon Bayrou, the cook, we can announce here on the House of Run podcast.
Yeah. I might come up with a cookbook one day. We'll see.
Well, that brings me to my last question. I'm glad you brought it up. What do you plan to do? I know this is looking way in advance, but like, what type of runner are you going to be when you retire? Are you going to be a guy who keeps running and keeps racing? Or when you're done professionally, are you going to be just sort of moving on to other things?
I'm going to be like only running it in shorts and t-shirt weather. It's by then. It's, you know, I think when I, you know, and everybody in my position, you know, when you're an elite runner, you really put everything into the basket because, you know, I want to look back in, 15, 20 years and say, I have no regrets at all. No matter what I accomplish, I just want to be able to say I did everything I could to get the best out of my ability. And if I'm going to do that, well, then when I'm retired, my legs are going to be dead. So I don't really plan on doing too much extreme running or, you know, intense running. But, you know, it's easier said than done. I'm sure I'll miss it and probably get back into it. But as of right now, I'm just kind of being a fair-weather runner and, you know, maybe going to some other things.
All right. His name is Simon Bayrou. SimonBayrou.com is his new website. He'll be running here. He'll be racing here in a couple weeks in Chicago. And then we'll look for you, Simon, in the Toronto Marathon in the fall. Thanks a lot for taking the time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.
And thanks again to Simon Bayrou for joining us on the House of Run podcast. I will be back with you all next week. Hopefully Jason will be in tow. In the meantime, you can email us, houseofrun@gmail.com. You can also tweet us, twitter.com/houseofrun. Or you can call our voicemail line, 206-339-4387. Also, we have an iTunes page. You can review us on iTunes. Leave comments, leave a rating, whatever you prefer. Until next week, my name is Kevin. Thanks for listening. Thanks for downloading. We will see you soon.